I'm not sure which one, Gene or Cisco. I don't know, the dead one or the guy that's dying or the fat one, whatever.
True love story between a man and his boy, his rent boy. I might have been in
love before. He called it himself a horrible movie. Our dreams are young and we both know
they'll take us where we want to go. Hello and welcome. We're back. It is episode 214 of the Baller Lifestyle Podcast. I, of course, am your host. My name is Brian Beckner. I am here every week. I am stoked that you are here to join us for a very special episode of the Baller Lifestyle Podcast. We're talking about a movie. We're talking about a classic movie. We've teased that we would discuss this. We had this group together before to discuss Karate Kid Part 2, quite possibly the worst movie in the history of Hollywood. Well, there was a sequel to that, Karate Kid Part 3, and we are here to talk about it now. I am joined, as always, by Ed Daly. Ed, what's up?
By Karate Kid 3, you mean best movie in Hollywood
history,
right?
It might be. It's exceptional. Also joined, as often, by Jason Stewart. Jason, how are you?
Hello, everybody.
A little tough to get a hold of you when we were at the time we were supposed to start. Was there Bing? Was Bing involved? Were you giving anybody viruses?
Let's just put it this way. I had a very strong root that is now a relaxed root.
Oh, my God. This is not that kind of show. And we are also joined by special guest of the show. He comes on from time to time to either review movies or discuss The Bachelor. He is a legend in the Bachelor community. Of course, I'm talking about Steve from Loyola Marymount University. Steve, how are you, buddy?
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Hey, Steve.
So stoked.
I've been waiting so long for this one. I think when we finished Karate Kid 2 is when I said, I will be on the next time, and it's going to be Karate Kid 3. We are doing this movie, and we finally got to it.
Yeah,
we had two inexperienced Karate Kid 3 guys.
Yeah. I know. This is unbelievable.
I lost my Karate Kid 3 virginity this weekend. So, yeah, I had never seen this movie. We wanted to discuss it. I knew it would be terrible or great or greatly terrible. So I was happy to jump in. I watched it for the first time this weekend, as I believe did Jason Stewart. Is that correct, Jason?
Yeah, I don't know what I was doing in 1989. I'm pretty sure I was working at a movie theater, my first paid job. I have no idea how this missed my radar. I have no idea why I did not see this, but I never did.
Well, it's kind of crazy.
Maybe you walked in during Act 1 and you just thought they were playing Karate Kid 1. Again.
Yeah.
Could be. This was not on my radar either. I knew there was a 1 and 2, and then I thought 3 was the one with that dude, Hillary Swank.
Yeah, I didn't see this in the theaters. This was like, you know, like a movie marathon in college kind of thing that showed up.
Yeah. So, well,
and let's make a clarification that this franchise ended with this movie. I don't count
Next
Karate Kid with Hillary Swank. I don't count the Jackie Chan and Will Smith kid one. No, that's just delete those from the annals of cinematography.
The Will Smith kid one, he's like 10.
Yeah.
I mean, who's invested in a love story where nobody has sex?
Yeah. How's he have a love interest? Well, I mean,
hard pass on any love interest that's not having sex.
In Will Smith's kid's defense, Danielson's not having any sex.
I mean, that's pretty much my first note about this movie, is that they completely clip the balls off of any kind of romantic storyline, with the woman admitting right away, I've got a boyfriend in Columbus and I'm leaving in a couple months. Like, what kind of stupid plot line is that on a romantic sense?
Well, that's because they wanted there to be nothing in between the true love story between a man and his boy, his rent boy.
Or a man and his tiny little pine trees. Okay, quickly, let's talk about The Karate Kid Part 3. We'll give you the particulars. It came out in 1989. I was 14. I don't know. I feel like I was going to the movies a lot in 1989. I did not see this one. I didn't know it existed. It is, of course, a martial arts drama film. It's the second sequel to the original massive blockbuster, The Karate Kid from 1984. It stars, of course, Ralph Macchio and Pat Morita. And then there's a love interest played by Robin Lively, and she looked familiar. I think she's just kind of like bounced around TV shows forever. She's a redhead.
She's European Rusty Griswold's sister and Blake Lively's older sister. Like they're Hollywood royalty.
Right.
I believe the couple other things on Robin Lively. Number one, she was the older daughter in Wildcats.
That's right. She dyed her hair red.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. She was hot.
Or orange or something.
Yes.
She was still young then.
If I'm not mistaken, I believe she was probably on every ABC after school special dealing with bulimia back when I was in high school and watching health
1991,
videos.
1991 ABC after school specials. Melissa Harmon.
Not quite human. She had a robot brother, like a small wonder type
thing.
The
less than perfect daughter. Oh, wait. She was a nurse on Doogie Howser for a couple years.
Nurse.
Guest appearance on Quantum Leap, Chicago Hope. Dream a Little Dream 2, who could forget? Oh, the reboot of The Love Boat in 98. Love Boat, The Next Wave, X-Files.
She probably was Vicky, right?
Yeah, Crossing Jordan, The Drew Carey Show. She bounced around.
Actually called The Next Wave.
Yeah, Love Boat, The Next Wave.
Yeah, the Love Boat's like a cruiser line. Yeah, there's no like waves.
You don't
there's
want
no
there
waves.
To be waves.
It's not a catamaran.
No, that's the worst.
Well, there was a wave of cocaine that hit Julie.
that's right.
Well, one thing is for certain about this cast, if you want to start with Robin, either it was purposefully done on the cheap, hiring unknowns and hope to will be superstars. I mean, the two villains I have not heard of since. And this Robin Lively is very forgettable. Nobody took off from this movie. Let's make that plain and clear.
Well, somebody, yes.
But the two villains that didn't take off, that's Hollywood's fault. Not 100%. Not their fault.
100%.
I mean, holy shit. These are great villains.
One of the villains, Thomas Ian Griffith, he plays Terry Silver. He later went on.
He played Rock Hudson in a biopic.
Yes, he played Rock Hudson. You're also looking at his Wikipedia. He was on a soap opera. He didn't do much, unfortunately, which is shocking because he was.
This was his film debut.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, his
film
first
debut. He gets to be Terry Silver.
First like, and last movie.
This is like Ichiro's rookie year, winning MVP.
Yeah,
no,
100%. And then, of course, the Karate's bad boy, Mike Barnes, who
played Jason Quartermain from General Hospital.
And I saw that he was in like 600 episodes, but that could only be like a month. They produce so That's many true. Of those shows.
But I know this from my mom. Apparently, he had a bit of a booger sugar problem.
Interesting.
And
yeah,
he kind of went off the General Hospital rails because it takes a lot to get fired from a soap.
It does. They really need you there every day.
667 episodes of Bold and the Beautiful for Mike Barnes, which is fascinating.
I'll tell you what, though. There are some honeys on those soap operas. I bet Mike Barnes was balls deep 24/7. He's a handsome fella. Two, he's Karate's bad boy. C, the guy is a martial artist. Like he's doing his moves. Chicks are into it. I bet he did very well for himself in the soap opera world. Okay, the plot of the movie. Everybody remembers.
Before we get to that, Brian.
Uh-oh. Yep.
I do need to point this out. If you look on the Wikipedia page,
I'm looking at it.
I'm not sure which one, Gene or Siskel. I don't know, the dead one or the guy that's dying or the fat one, whatever.
Oh, they're both
one
dead.
Of them.
Both dead.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, one of them said the saving grace about this movie was this guy, Terry Silver.
Absolutely.
The actor 100%. That played
of course. Terry Silver.
I thought it was a freaking over-the-top, ridiculous villain that sucked.
Oh, I agree to disagree.
I've never seen a more realistic depiction of a man.
100%. Yeah. So the plot of the movie, John Kreese, down on his luck. He's been waylaid by his loss, the loss of the Cobra Kai in the All Valley Karate Tournament, which is a little interesting because his guys were like all over the podium. Yeah, they didn't win like Daniel LaRusso won the title, but Bobby was top three, Johnny was second place, runner up. Like all of his guys, Tommy was in there, Dutch. Like it's weird that his whole dojo would fold despite the fact that he was all over the podium at the All Valley Karate Tournament, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where was he supposed to be? Where was Barnes supposed to be from?
I think Ohio, did they say? He imported him.
Well, I know he picked him out of a magazine. Like a lecherous mail order bride.
What was that ad? Karate's Bad Boy. What were they advertising in that magazine? That was very weird. So
he did a write up on high school kids.
He subscribed to all the hip karate magazines in 1989. That was the thing.
He asked his butler.
Terry Silver got in his Rolls. What was that? A Rolls Royce that he was in?
Yeah.
He's like,
yeah.
Give me the best karate mags that you can find while I roll to the airport, and I want to see who's good. I'm going to recruit him. This is basically AAU circuit on the karate level.
You know who also 100%. Did that? Jared from Subway. Yes. So get me the best kids karate magazines.
So we could just get into the movie. That's how it starts. John Kreese's dojo is done. He also apparently doesn't own a razor. He looks like he's down on his luck. And it's weird because the story picks up like just the karate tournament ends, and then Daniel and Miyagi, they go to Okinawa to sort shit out, like,
but
right afterwards.
But that's skipped from the montage.
What's that?
The Karate Kid 2
leave it
no
out.
Appearance in the montage.
Except
it's
for
just
Kimiko.
One.
But then they show him. So Kreese is down on his luck. He doesn't own a razor. His dojo's all dusty, and there's all this unopened mail. But it's only been a couple of weeks since the All Valley. Like, how has it gone to shit so quickly?
Yeah, the only thing that isn't dusty is the picture on the wall that says Captain John Kreese, U.S. Army 1970-72 Karate Champion. Yeah. So we were still active in Vietnam. I think they started signing papers in 72.
Right.
So in the middle of Vietnam, they were crowning karate champions.
Yeah, they're doing karate tournaments in the Army.
Yeah.
And Kreese is like done. The All Valley people are calling him for back dues, which can't be that much money, right? And also, how is it? The tournament just ended. They're already looking to collect for next year.
Yeah, and if you know anything about youth sports, like as a parent, like you got to pay all that money up front. Yeah. So like, even if these parents are like, "Fuck this, we're not doing this," it would take a long time for him to be out of money.
Oh yeah, you got to they auto pay that stuff now. They deduct.
Yes.
Like you're not getting out of that without a court order. So
this is my question for Carbone, because I know he's the resident expert on this particular movie.
100%.
What is the timeline here, Steve? Because if he's down and out and he's getting collection calls from the All Valley tournament the following year, I mean, what are we supposed to believe? Because he shipped to Tahiti. I mean, what's the timeline here? It confuses me within the first 10 minutes. What are we looking at here?
They never really dive into exactly how long after one ended and two, like, when did they go to Okinawa? How long were they in Okinawa? Do we really, I guess if we added up all the days that they talked about when Sato said you got 3 days to mourn and all this. I mean, we really don't know when this one was, but we know the All Valley is held that first weekend in December based on the poster the first
That's
movie.
That's right. December 19th. It said
so
December
I'm guessing,
19th. But
I'm guessing we're a year later.
For UCLA guy, right? Wasn't that didn't we realize that Gaston Green was banging Allie with an eye?
Yeah. That's right. So that would have been prom season, which was what?
That's
June.
May-ish.
So yeah, this is probably 6 months after. So he goes to Okinawa in the summer of that year.
The scene So he goes to the Okinawa, but they do say that one scene where he approaches Silver when he's beating up homeless men to classical music, he says, I haven't had a new student in 9 months. So we have to assume it's November. I mean, it's September. Yes. Right?
Okay. So he just got back from Okinawa. Yeah, it's around September. So we got 3 months till this tournament. Okay.
Parents pay up front. Like, there's no way that he would be out of money.
No, no, 100%. Got to agree with that. So Kreese is down on his luck, and he's like all good Army Rangers. He's just immediately ready to give up. He goes... He goes and visits his rich buddy with a ponytail, and his buddy is like super wealthy. He lives in like a museum, and immediately we find out that his business is nuclear waste, nuclear waste dumping. Which I thought was a little on the nose.
I wrote down that I thought it was he was like an early cell phone guy.
No, he's like,
was he dumping nuclear waste? Like,
what do you mean you can't?
I thought it was like Silver Tech Corp.
No, he's like, what do you mean you can't dump plutonium in Borneo? It used to be that.
That's right. But when you meet him, he's got his Pat Riley slick back with the ponytail.
He's amazing.
But he's just rolling homeless dudes in padding.
Yeah,
like he's just he's just playing like Bach and just rolling homeless dudes with mullets.
Also, he's bathing a lot. He takes a lot of meetings while bathing. He's in the sauna, on the phone. He's in a tub with people around him. He's got a lot of servants. He's smoking cigars. He's got all the trappings of a very, very rich dude, like a Daddy Warbucks type, a very cartoonish rich man with a ponytail, right?
It encapsulates what evil was in 1989: nuclear waste,
100%,
and rich people
in ponytails,
and a ponytail. And so, what's the nature of his relationship? He was in Kreese's platoon, and he's a Cobra Kai alum. Is that the deal?
Well,
he saved his life more times than he can count.
That's
right.
That's a lot of.
Sense. Oh yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's my note. It said like they wanted to. This was like in the establishing scenes. He yearned for the good old days of dumping nuclear waste.
Yeah.
Yeah. Last week you said you couldn't dump nuclear waste.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So Kreese and Terry Silver are old buddies, and Kreese is like, "Hey, I'm hanging him up. Like this fucking the karate game. It's just not for me. I haven't had a new student." And Terry Silver's like, fuck that. He's like, you just need a vacation, buddy. And so he sends him off. He sends him off
to Tahiti,
and they drive up to LAX, and he drops a very unfortunate racial term, and he does it twice in the movie. He calls Miyagi a slope, which I feel was very uncalled for.
Hey, Johnny, why don't you go get yourself a few soapy massages from the locals?
Yeah.
And I'm gonna go murder this old slope.
Yeah.
And I can't remember. Isn't it one of those scenes where Kreese like walks into the airport as Daniel's son?
Yeah. Miyagi are coming off of the plane from Okinawa.
Back to Steve's point, like they just went on a quick vacation. They're back. And Kreese is all down and out. Yes, like
exactly.
All they could have done is gone to Okinawa. That's all they've done.
Right. They've been in Okinawa a couple weeks. They arrive home, and of course,
but an important thing here. And Steve, let me know if I've left anything out. Like the rich guy, the new villain. We were introduced to a new villain,
Terry
and
Silver.
They're shipping out the old villain.
Yeah.
And Silver has made him a list of promises. Not only is he's gonna make the two guys in pain.
That's right.
Kreese makes him promise to bloody their knuckles. Like, what's the deal with it? What kind of promises has he made here, Steve?
Well, I think it's funny if you look at these actors. I think one thing that needs to be told right off the bat when it comes to Terry Silver and Daniel LaRusso is at the time of this filming, and I guess. Still to this day, in real life, Daniel LaRusso is 4 months older than Terry Silver. How great is that? And then straight from the IMDb page, Thomas Ingram.
Is that for real?
Yeah. Thomas Ingram. They're both born in 62. I looked it up. So It says on the IMDb page for the movie that Thomas Ian Griffith, who portrays a Vietnam veteran, was only 13 years old when the Vietnam War ended. So any thoughts of him being saved by Kreese in Vietnam? Yeah, no. But when you look at it, he did look like he could be, I mean, Rob Macho Drew's the Fountain of Youth, basically.
Right,
I mean,
of course.
But
Macho doesn't look 27.
Here. Ralph Macchio was 28 when the movie was made, and so was Silver. But Ralph Macchio is 4 months older than him in real life.
Crazy.
Which, watching it, you're like, Silver looks about young 30s, and Macchio looks 21. Yeah. Like, that's how I look at it.
And Kreese looks 58. Like, it's weird that he and Silver are contemporaries. So Daniel, they cross at the airport. Daniel and Miyagi are getting off the plane. They're like, all right, hey, where's my mom? Like, no one, these people have a real hard time making phone calls. Like, the whole plot of Karate Kid Part 2 could have been solved with one phone call during the course of 40 years. And again, they arrive at the airport, and he's like, where's your mom? Oh, I don't know. I must have told her the wrong day.
But also remember the beginning of Karate Kid 2, they have that whole weird scene where he builds like a wing to his house because he's like, you're living with me. They went on a vacation, and then it's like, oh, what are we going to do? Right. Like,
yeah. So then they go to his apartment in Reseda, and they're physically tearing down the apartment. And he's like, oh, I have nowhere to live. Well, the whole plot of the beginning of Karate Kid Part 2 was that he was moving in with, Miyagi, like
that's right.
It's like they hadn't.
So they should have just picked up where they left off.
Yeah, they hadn't watched the second movie.
And also, why would he be surprised by, like, they don't move that quickly in dismantling apartment building. No. Like, he didn't know that they were. He only went to Okinawa. Well, he didn't live in Okinawa for 6 months.
Well, you could say that, but the woman that hangs out by the pool was sitting out front on her suitcase. Like, they showed up to demolish the building, and she was still living there.
Definitely was going to Skid Row.
She had nowhere to go.
That cab was not taking her anywhere.
To me, this scene is like the most realistic part of the movie. To me, it brought me back to a time, and it made me think, like, before cell phones.
Yeah,
people did just show up to disasters. Like, there was, you know, nowadays, if something happens to me, I text my parents and say, I was just home invaded. But in the 80s, like, you had to show up in person to find out that something horrible had happened. And how about this for a tangential question for you guys? In the 80s, how did you pick anybody up from the airport?
It's crazy. It's crazy. You would just show up at a time. How did
hope that the flight was on time.
Outside of a stadium or something.
Jason.
And that was when you were allowed to go in and wait at the gate. You didn't have to wait at baggage claim. You just walk in and just go to their gate and stand there as they come off the plane and wave to them.
You could cruise in. Now, Jason, is home invaded, is that some sort of euphemism for anal sex?
Home invaded. That's a good point.
You had your home invaded. So Daniel's house is being torn down. His mom sets him up to live with Miyagi, which she did in the second movie already. I don't know why they do it again. And then he has a phone call with his mom. She's bounced to New Jersey to see Ed Daly and to take care of his sickly Uncle Louie, who looks like he's only got a couple more days. And she's like, hey, what's up with you and Kimiko? And and Daniel, who was in love with
that
Kimiko.
That was the only reference to Karate Kid 2, right?
Yeah, he was in love with Kimiko like 2 days before that in the timeline. Like, they were going to spend their lives together. He's like, oh no, she got a job with some dance company in Tokyo. So she was like, fuck off.
And then how about Miyagi? Like, the long love, the true love of his life. Because they in Karate Kid 2, they made it seem like his marriage was a complete sham and his true love was this woman.
Right.
And it's like, well, I do have a flight home, so peace.
See you later. He falls in love in the second movie with his long lost love who he couldn't have called for 40 years. And it's just over. It's like 2 days later.
Yeah.
But we do find out in this scene what the true love of Miyagi's life is. And that is, of course, trimming tiny little trees. Bonsai. It's all about Bonsai.
Have you ever thought about opening a Bonsai store? Like, that's one of his first questions to Miyagi when he gets out.
Has anyone ever thought of that? Who's ever seen a Bonsai store?
Have you ever seen a Bonsai store?
Yes. Like, I know there are a bunch of little shops that sell. You could find a shop that sells anything. And even in 1989, I can't for the life of me think anybody would go to a shop to buy a tree.
No.
It's a front. If it's a front, I guess that's what it is.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you're definitely selling heroin.
If you're selling cocaine. Yeah, exactly. So, and then we see Kreese is like, he's getting massages in a very fake looking Tahitian set. And he's got two, he's getting the four hands massage. Jason knows what I'm talking about. And,
but wait, one thing. Yeah. So when the reason why he's talking about the Bonsai store being a possibility,
It's
because Bianchi's out of a job. Yeah. So they're like, oh, what are you going to do for money? Like, well, how about selling like one of your 19 vintage cars? Yeah.
He also has a palatial plot of land by some train tracks. Like who's got 4 acres in LA?
But yeah, when people like downsize in life, like the first thing they would do is sell their first 18 cars. Yes.
Yeah. Also, he's got skills. Like he's a handyman. Like it's not like a super high barrier of entry to get another job. Just being like he could probably go to the apartments next door where they already know him.
And he didn't lose his job at the Beverly Hills Hotel. Like he could be a handyman. Literally anywhere.
Yeah, just go to the next apartment complex in Reseda, and I'm sure they'll hook you up and they'll let you do a little Bonsai while you're there.
They lived in what looked like the place where Butch killed Vincent Vega.
100%. Yeah. And to think he could set his sights on grooming another young man. Like if he went to the next apartment complex, he's already been through Daniel. Like he can move on to the next guy for sure. Kreese is reporting back to Terry Silver. Terry Silver is
he promised him 20 dojos.
Alerts him that he's bought him 20 dojos. It's going to be Cobra Kai all over the valley when he gets back. And Kreese and he's like, and oh, by the way, we're going to fuck up Miyagi and that kid. But Kreese has a very strange request. He says, I want you to make his knuckles bleed. Well, that's your knuckles bleed when you're punching somebody. You don't assault somebody in their knuckles. Like the knuckles.
Yeah.
Did you find that strange, Steve Carbone?
Well, a lot about this movie was strange, but yeah, I mean, it didn't really make a hell of a lot of sense because the only thing I can think of is when he's telling Terry Silver that he's basically telling Terry Silver, hey, go fight Miyagi. But when you do, make sure you're standing in front of the driver's side of a car and make sure he's the one attacking you first and then move out of the way. Like that's the only way you get bloody knuckles, really, right? Exactly. I mean, we saw it in number two. Like
and also
a lot of sense.
What is the business model? Because he said it was going to be 20 dojos like under Kreese's name. So that if a new dojo opened up, they'd be like, oh, who's this guy? Like Tiger Shulman is a name, right?
Yeah.
So they'd be like, oh, who's this guy? Oh, that's the guy that tried to strangle one of his students 9 months ago for not winning a trophy.
Yeah. Or they'd be like,
what?
That's the guy that got top 4 out of 5 places at last year's All Valley, but he must suck at teaching karate.
And also when Daniel is ready to give up his tuition money, this has happened in 2 straight movies. Like he desperately, the ongoing theme is Daniel wants to get rid of his college tuition to pay for Miyagi related stuff.
Yeah. He used it to buy his flight to Okinawa unannounced. And then he used it again to buy Miyagi a Bonsai store that we never really got the sense Miyagi was interested in owning.
Zero interest in owning.
Yeah.
Like what, when he told him that, it's like, no, you're going to go to college.
Of course.
No, I don't want to go to college. I want to open a Bonsai store for you. What?
Yeah.
What kind of backwards thinking is that?
Yeah, that would be the moment where you go, that's why you need to go to college, because that's a crazy statement.
It's
that's
a horrible
not something
business.
People do with their money.
You go to college and take a business entrepreneurship class, because what you're proposing right now is godless.
It's crazy.
We are going to fail. So you can't even succeed in the restaurant industry. You want to open up a store in the valley selling fucking trees. What?
I think that to me is just one of the many inherent flaws with this script. I mean, and I would say this: Daniel puts up his money for. They had a list of it, first and last, security deposit in like six months or whatever it was. And about 10 minutes into the lease, Daniel is sweating Miyagi that they're not going to be able to make a profit. Like, you're the idiot who put up all the money, you dumbass.
Yeah, well, at least Daniel came up with a real catchy name.
Okay. What was it?
I know what we should call it. Mr. Miyagi's Little Trees. Catchy. Oh yeah, it's great.
Yeah. It's fucking weird that they're best friends and he can't be on a first name basis with Mr. Miyagi.
Right. Yeah. The dude is ski poling on him every night and he can't call him, you know, whatever his real first name is.
We kind of need to back up real quick a second here, because when we go back to Silver, unless you're going to talk about Silver and when Mike Barnes shows up.
Yeah, that's what I was just about to talk about.
Go to that, because I've got a lot to say.
Mike
about
Barnes, it. By the way, has four names. You got to call him
Karate's Bad. Karate's Bad.
Five names. So.
Yeah, we see earlier Silver's checking out his karate mags, as one does. And he sees an ad, or I don't know if it's a feature.
Doesn't he have his help like just hand him a stack?
Yeah, he said, "Give me my magazines." And it's just a full page of this guy's face, and he's doing like a karate pose, and it says "Karate's Bad Boy, Mike Barnes."
It says "Tournament Terrier, Karate's Bad Boy, Mike Barnes."
Terry Silver imports Mike Barnes, and he's brought in by his henchmen Snake and Dennis.
Snake loves his gold chains.
Okay, do we know? Okay, right there. Yes. Do we all know who Snake is? Yeah,
Snake. So that is kind of interesting.
The actor, you mean the actor? Right?
Yeah, the actor.
Snake.
Yeah, go ahead and tell everybody. I just found this out.
Snake is the least intimidating looking human being you've ever seen. He's short. He's pudgy. Like anybody could just flick him away, and you're wondering, how did this guy get cast in this movie, as he's so obviously unintimidating? And what do we learn, Steve Carbone?
Snake is played by Jonathan Avildsen, the son of director John G. Avildsen, who screen tested. Snake screen tested for Mike Barnes. He did such a fine job that the role of Snake Silver, Terry's son, was created especially for him. So he's Terry's son. Is that ever established in the movie?
No, I didn't realize that.
He's just
that
from the goons.
Yeah. I didn't know
straight
this.
Straight from the IMDb page. Yeah.
Holy Another. Shit. Snake's his kid. Unbelievable. Wow. But imagine what this movie would have been if Snake, John Avildsen Jr., had played Karate's Bad Boy Mike Barnes. I mean, that would have been amazing.
I mean, let's back it up a little bit. This is the same director that did the original Rocky.
Yeah.
He did a couple of the Rockies. He did the initial Karate Kid. Like, he's got some chops. He understands the genre. And he casts his kid. There's a disconnect here. The director has to know that these characters and these lines are so over the top and unbelievable. Like, literally not believable. Snake plays a person that has never existed. I don't know how he could have possibly taken these lines and these takes and been like, yeah, that's the one we're going to ship to the we're going to use. Like, that character is so awful, and it's the son of the director completely confounds me.
I think our man Avildsen was cashing a check, Jason. I think he saw the writing on the wall. He thought, holy shit, they're making another one of these pieces of shit. Yeah, I'll sign on. And it's kind of like the producer that's like, hey, you got to put my mistress in this fucking movie. That's how we're going to do it. John Avildsen was like, hey, look, I'll sign on. I'll do it for my quote, but you got to put my fucking kid in the movie. I want him to play Mike Barnes. And then there's some negotiation where they're like, look, your son is a tub of shit. Nobody's going to buy him as Karate's Bad Boy, but he does look kind of sinister. So let's just have him be Snake. What do you say? Okay. Yeah. Sounds good.
We also have to give an RIP to John Avildsen, who passed away in June of last year.
He just recently died. Yeah. RIP. Sorry about that, Snake.
If you click on Snake's like IMDb facts page, it says like son of John Avildsen, brother of Anthony Avildsen, and it says zero people found this interesting. I guess you can weigh in.
So good. So Terry seems to bathe a lot. He's got Mike Barnes. He offers, and this is, I mean, I don't think anybody really did the math here. Because
bubble bath.
Because he's in the bath, he's smoking a cigar, he's got all his minions around him, whatever. Mike Barnes comes in with Snake and Dennis to have a negotiation, and he's like, look, he's like, your karate's bad boy. I offered you 25% of my new dojos if you beat this kid. And he's like, yeah, he's like, I thought about that. And he's like, I'm going to need 50%. And Terry Silver's like, well, I don't know. I can only offer 35. And then they have a negotiation, and karate's bad boy Mike Barnes goes to leave. He just walks out on the 35% offer. But then Terry Silver's like, oh, if you fight like you negotiate, I think we're going to be fine. And he's like, so you get your 50%. But this, he's just giving him a controlling interest in the company because he's partners with Kreese. So now Kreese and Silver are suddenly...
I mean, he got rich somehow from dumping nuclear waste. Yeah. Like, how did he... He's such a terrible negotiator.
Yeah, all of a sudden, he's a quarter share owner of the business, and he's working for karate's bad boy Mike Barnes.
He got worked by a bad boy in a jean jacket.
He really did. And then he was off to train with Snake and Dennis. What else? There's a whole bunch more bonsai after this. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, I think one thing we have to point out here is the reason that Silver is after karate's bad boy Mike Barnes is because obviously he wants to win back the Cobra Kai name, but we have now been told, I don't know why this is a unilateral rule that was implemented in 1989 All Valley Karate.
Oh, this is great. Yes, yeah.
But Daniel, his whole point of bringing in Mike Barnes is so he can beat Daniel, and Daniel, being the defending champion, only has to fight in the championship match. I don't know where this comes from. So, like, you know, the Eagles won the Super Bowl. Do they just get a bye to this next year's Super Bowl and just have to play in the final game? What type of tournament is this where you just get to skip to the end because you won the year before?
That doesn't make any sense. Weird. It's kind of weird.
Remember in the first Karate Kid when they show the tournament bracket on the wall and there's all these different updates?
Yeah.
Like in the final scene of this one, there's like five names. That's it. Yeah. Like nobody's competing.
It's a much smaller tournament because Cobra Kai's gotten out of business. That was like 90% of the guys that were in the tournament the year before. There's no Johnny. There's no Bobby. There's no Dutch. No. Dutch is probably doing a bid in Wasco by this point. Yeah.
And that's where I think that, like, somehow, even though this was the third movie of two movies that made a lot of money, you'd think that they would have an endless budget for this third one. Not only did they go cheap on the villains and a couple of no-names, love interest and whatnot, they employed none of the original Cobra Kai. Like, to me, it was like, I don't know if it was a budget maneuver or what, but to me, that's a massive thing missing from this movie. If the movie is only a year after the fact, couldn't they have Johnny or one of these schizos showing up and like wreaking havoc on Kreese or something?
That's a great point. Not even Johnny, because, I mean, not that he was working so much after back to school, but those other guys couldn't have cost more than like $15.
Right.
You know, like, we'll buy you half of a lunch.
Especially Tommy and Dutch. Like, how cool would it have been to see, instead of Snake and Dennis, there could be Tommy and Dutch. Like, those guys are fucking bloodthirsty villains. Would love to see them again.
I think for the sake of devil's advocate here, I'll play the role of why that didn't happen. And it's because of what Kreese did at the beginning of Karate Kid 2. They don't want to go work for him. They don't want to be part of Cobra Kai because he touched Johnny Lawrence. And he basically tried to kill Johnny Lawrence with his bare hands. So that would be my thinking, is that, look, we don't want to be part of this psycho. We don't want to go back to Cobra Kai. Now, if they would have come in as another faction and maybe
third
Daniel's Yeah, and just been a third, just been a, that would have made more sense, but then it would have got confusing because they basically wanted to make this movie Cobra Kai versus Daniel's Karate and Let's Regain Our Name. So in that aspect, I see why they didn't. Let's give them a break.
It makes sense.
But you can, but back to, I think, Jason's point about them shaving bucks off the budget. Like, the second movie was not expecting to be bad. But they had the Peter Cetera, like, you know, big hit. But that was like a big hit. This one, I don't even think there's any artists that, like, they weren't trying to do anything here. They didn't try to get, like, a, you know, a popular artist at the time. Like, there's no music. There's no other stars. Like,
no Wang Chung.
The song for the credits, I looked it up. I Shazammed the song for the credits.
Wow.
And that's, it is a... What? It is a complete departure. Let's see. I'm going to look at my history of Shazamming, which I did last night.
Check it out. Yeah.
And it's, you would think that, again, maybe they had a problem selling this movie because the Little River Band owns the song at the beginning of the credits called Listen to Your Heart. Little River Band? What the fuck is that?
Oh, no. Little River Band was big in the 70s. They were, like, trying to get something going.
Yeah, they were not big in 1989.
No, that's for sure. That's for sure.
The only artist in this movie that was recognizable was when they went to the dance club later on in the movie where Daniel just fucking throttled the guy in the nose.
That was the best part.
That artist that was singing in the background when Daniel was doing that awful, horrible dancing, was Glenn Medeiros. He had one hit back in the late 80s, and I'm blanking on the name of that hit, but I do remember the hit. He didn't sing it in the movie, but that artist, if you look at the credits, was Glenn Medeiros.
And he had
one hit in the 80s.
Oh, I know this song. I like that you think Glenn Medeiros is a recognizable artist.
Well, he was
Glenn Medeiros,
but I have clicked on his name and I do see his IMDb or his Wikipedia page. And his hit was Nothing's Gonna Change My Love For You.
Yes.
You ought to know by now how much I love you. One thing you can be sure of. I'll never ask for more than your love. Nothing's gonna, that's it.
That's him in the club. What about, oh, you know what else he had?
No.
She Ain't Worth It, featuring Bobby Brown.
Oh, I don't know that one.
She Ain't Worth It. The girl ain't worth it. You remember that one, right?
Oh, no, I don't.
I wish I did. Glenn Medeiros. Okay.
Glenn Medeiros. I had no idea.
So we do have one guy that had some sort of importance in the late 80s in the pop culture music scene.
He definitely was around. Yeah, I do.
You know who didn't have any relevance? Danielson. Like,
no.
He's wearing mom jeans. Like, you can't lead a movie with mom jeans.
He and his love interest both have their guest jeans. They're like fighting to see who can get their jeans pulled up the highest. And I know that
whoever touches nipples first wins.
Right. I know that was a style in the 80s, but for women, I don't remember dudes hiking their pants up to their nipples, but there you go with Danielson. So what happens in this movie? There's a lot of bonsai between, we get introduced to Mike Barnes, we get introduced to Terry Silver, and there's a lot of bonsai in between. There's pottery, there's bonsai.
Yeah, we get introduced to bonsai. Like it's so a major character in the movie.
Yeah, they're doing bonsai, but then it reverts to form. The bad guys need to, they can't do the tournament and just fuck everybody else up in the tournament. That's not going to get the Cobra Kai name back on the map. They have to beat the existing champion and the reigning champion, and Danielson's not down. At first, he's sort of into it, but Miyagi's like, nah, you ain't going to fight. What's wrong with you? But then they basically have to attempt to murder Danielson a whole bunch of times to get him to agree to sign the application to be in the fight, right?
Could answer this question. Why exactly is Miyagi so dead set against training Daniel for this? What is the exact reason?
Wrong reasons.
Because karate is not for trophies. Karate is for defense only.
That's right. That's exactly.
It's right. It's not for the glory. You don't do it for the glory. You don't do it for titles and All Valley championships back to back years. You do it because you respect the craft.
That's right.
And he thought that going back into a tournament was not the way, you know, Miyagi always trained you, but for tournament, cannot.
So Miyagi trained him in number one to revenge all of the harassment. And then Daniel almost got killed and then almost killed the Okinawan in number two out of principles that are karate-esque.
Right.
But for some reason, Miyagi would not.
Yeah, he fought Chosen to death and then opted not to kill him.
Yeah, he could have killed him.
And then there's three. You skip to three, and Miyagi refuses to train Daniel, and Daniel keeps begging him to train him.
Yeah,
dude, he already trained you karate. Why the fuck do you need more training? Really, you've already been trained in two movies, for Christ's sake.
If you already want to fight till the death
with Chosen,
like you're pretty good in good shape.
Yeah, Chosen was trained by Sato. Like, he's an Okinawan master. You fucked him up. You should be able to fuck up karate's bad boy, Mike Barnes, without any training.
He was Japan's karate bad boy.
Exactly.
But I think the thing was that the two times that, you know, Daniel and Jessica were getting frisky late at night in the bonsai store, and karate's bad boy, Mike Barnes, and Snake and Dennis came in and basically said, look, you're going to defend your title. I need your title. That's what he said. I need your title, basically, so he could get silver as money and crease his dojos. But when Daniel first went to Miyagi to tell him, I need you to train me, he even said, I can't beat this guy.
Yeah.
Like, he's kicking my ass left and right. He took my macaroni and cheese and threw it on the ground.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah, I need your training. He's going to beat me. I suck.
Yeah.
That's what he said. Like, after being chosen in a fight to the death, he knows that Mike Barnes is 100 times better than him, which he was.
So Barnes and Dennis and Snake, they come in to the macaroni and cheese date, and they're fucking up the Mr. Miyagi's little trees bonsai shop pretty good. And this is a trope from the Okinawa days, where maybe they shouldn't make like all the walls out of paper and shit, because it just people want to fuck you up. They'll just come and rip the shit down. Like, maybe build some stuff out of wood or bricks or something. They come in there, and Daniel kind of like he punches or kicks Dennis in the gut pretty good. But then Mike Barnes comes over and he just absolutely fucks Daniel up. I mean, he really just kicks his ass.
And Jessica,
he
kicks his chick right in the gut, which is assault. And it's weird because they don't do anything about that. They're like, oh, yeah, that was fucked up. I can't believe they want me to sign that paper. Then they go back to the house. They go back to their shared domicile at Miyagi's, and they've stolen all of their bonsai trees and left a note. And Daniel's like, oh, I'm calling the cops. Wait, they just tried to kill you a little while ago. They assaulted a woman. Yeah, and you didn't think to call the police, but they jacked a couple of your tiny pine trees, and you're real pissed off and calling the police now. That was kind of strange.
And they boned out and did donuts in the car on the way, and almost got hit by a train.
Yes.
And the other thing about, I think what also makes karate's bad boy Mike Barnes the baddest man on the planet is while he's fighting Daniel during that, he's talking shit to him the whole time. Like, nice punch, nice kick, you suck.
He's like Larry
nothing
Bird.
You can do. Your offense is garbage to me. Like, I'm karate's bad boy. You won a tournament on a stupid little move that nobody's ever done since. And you tried in the second movie. You should have referenced the fact that, dude, you've tried this in Okinawa and it.
We heard about your crane attempt against Chosen.
It's a trash move.
It got back to the States that your crane attempt against Chosen was a joke.
That's probably what put the Cobra Kai out of business, is that everyone in the karate world saw that weak ass crane kick and they're like, oh my fucking
God. Johnny walked right into that.
Dude, exactly. Foreshadowing.
And remember, like, yes, she said she had a long distance boyfriend. But
back in Columbus,
she went on it. I mean, the guy's in fucking Columbus. She went on a date while her boyfriend's in Columbus. Like, something could have been at play. And he opens the date up by going, well, let's go Dutch. Yeah. We can go Dutch.
What a hoser. Total.
He
in his mom jeans and his red jacket that looked like a looked like it was $9.99 from Target. It looked plastic, like something you get at a Dodger game. Like, it was just awful.
Blake Lively and is wearing.
After we go Dutch, I put a note that like, yeah, and then he introduces him. He goes, "Oh, I got to introduce you my best friend," but he never like indicates who it is. Yeah, it's some old dude who may or may not be fucking me.
Yeah.
And Jessica's really impressed. Like, oh my God, he was so nice. Like, wow, he seems really smart. And Miyagi said like one sentence to her. Yeah. She tries to feign some sort of interest in Daniel's friend when in the back of her mind she's thinking, holy fuck, I just asked a guy on a date when I have a better guy back home in Ohio. And he's got a male Asian man in his early 70s as his best friend.
Well, that's the thing.
When he mentioned, like, she never had the conversation. Like, when you were talking about this best friend, why didn't you tell me he's, like, your grandfather, Asian grandfather?
No, she sees the writing on the wall because she's familiar with the zip code rule where she's like, hey, look, I got a boyfriend back home and I'm leaving in a few days. So just, you know, that's what's up. And she's like kind of telling Daniel, hey, let's make this a fling situation.
Yeah. She opens the door for him to just have a casual sex. And that's the thing that he never picks up on. He's like, oh, cool. Well, then it can't be anything. So let's do Dutch and let me ruin my chances of getting anything close to female. And then I have to, and you guys correct me if I'm wrong. Was it this date that she showed up in mom jeans, a tucked in pink sweater and leg warmers?
Yeah, I thought this was the turtleneck with flowers all over it.
Might have been.
Okay, so the next day it was a tucked in pink sweater.
She has the leg warmers, I believe, when they go rappelling.
Oh yeah. That's when correct.
They I think at this point, I think we should insert the fact that another IMDb note from this movie, which pertains to this particular topic we're talking about, Ralph Macchio's character was supposed to have a romantic relationship with the character of Jessica, but he asked to have their relationship be platonic because he didn't want his wife to be jealous.
Oh,
holy pussy. God.
What a fucking pussy. Isn't that the whole reason you get into acting?
What? Like, when is he getting this much creative control over storylines? No, I don't want to touch her because my wife might get mad. Oh, are you serious, Daniel?
Fucking God. And no wonder he hasn't worked since.
Yeah.
Right. Man. And don't they establish at some point she's going to make the clay pots for their business?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So they got bonsai and clay pots like as if they're operating a business in the 1830s in Peking, China.
No wonder they're like, over by the train
What is
tracks.
This business model?
Yeah. Okay, so one thing we've forgotten to discuss is Terry Silver – he has a weird, this is a weird plot line. He has a double agent routine worked out where what he's going to do, and it's sort of unclear. He has his minions pull up like a shitty old Civic and some other piece of shit. And then a truck with the top cut off. And he's like, this is perfect. 'Cause he wants to look poor. And then he shows up to Miyagi's and he's like, hey, I'm Kreese's buddy from Nam. And I just want to say that I trained with him and our master back in South Korea is so embarrassed about the way he does karate. That's not karate. And his whole thing is to sort of insinuate himself with Daniel and become Daniel's trainer.
Basically, Instagram stalk Daniel and know where he is at all times so he could be right there for him.
But then,
in hopes that he could train him.
Is his game?
Yeah, so
he'd
be like, wow, that guy is really humble. The guy with the slick back ponytail is like super humble.
Is his game to like train Daniel badly so he loses to Mike Barnes? He's obviously a much inferior martial artist to Mike Barnes already. Like, I don't know that him training him made him worse. He actually made him a better karate man by making him punch 2x4s a lot, right?
I think my sense was that the whole reason for the turn and to get him to train Daniel was to make him believe that he was better than he was because he knew Mike Barnes was better than him anyway. And he wanted to build Daniel up to thinking, oh my God, I'm invincible. Like I can punch boards. I can get bruises on my foot from kicking boards. I can punch guys and break their nose. When in reality, he wasn't really teaching him anything. I don't think.
Their training sessions were weird. Yes, Jason.
Him, you know, volunteering to train him is one thing, but could we kind of delve into exactly what this villain's motive was by telling them that Kreese was dead? What was the reason behind that whole deception? Why do that?
Yeah, I know you're going to be broken up by the guy that was your tormentor is dead.
Yeah, I didn't get that part.
If you convinced him Miyagi was dead, it would fuck him up. Yeah. But like, Kreese, like, you mean the biggest shithead in the yeah. neighborhood?
He's dead, but we're kind of happy.
Easy come, easy go.
Terry Silver, he pulls a weird double agent shit. He's got a Kreese is
Doesn't
dead
he do, like a cat burglar thing where he like sneaks around that's in Miyagi's
the,
house.
That's the next thing he does a recon mission. Not hard to break in because again, Miyagi builds his domiciles out of paper and balsa wood.
We're supposed to believe this guy is like a billionaire though, because he's thrown around like tens of millions, even in the 80s, just to get Kreese even with Daniel-san. He's a billionaire and he's like sneaking around like a cat burglar in the paper walls of Miyagi domicile.
It's very weird. And the whole point of it is to get recon, to get some information about Miyagi. And he finds out like he was in World War II. Like, I don't know like how much that could have benefited him, but apparently it did. I would like to get,
and then he sends Barnes into the backyard while Daniel is kicking one of those things that boxers punch.
Right.
Just a punching bag.
Heavy bag, yep.
Yeah, heavy bag. Here comes Mike Barnes into the backyard, and just one of the greatest fool jobs ever done in cinematic history. He comes in, basically starts kicking Daniel's ass for like a fourth time in this movie.
Yep.
And here comes Terry Silver, just happens to be coming in the backyard to drop off that book that he told Daniel he'd drop off about lake sweeps. Yeah. And then he fake kick Mike Barnes' ass, tells him to get out of there, and that's his like in with Daniel. Now Daniel sees like, wow, this guy will protect me. Miyagi's being a little bitch, won't train me. I need to train. This guy's got a book and he can kick Mike Barnes' ass. Like, I'm in. I'm sold.
Yes. He hangs with Kreese. Absolutely. He was a Nam.
He was a Nam. Like, wow. Like, fuck Miyagi. Like, what did this guy ever teach me to do?
Terry Silver is the true star of the movie. The guy is amazing.
I have a note around here, and I didn't write down the context, but Robin Lively is wearing a giant sweater with a hashtag on it. Like,
oh, is that true?
Which means, but there was no hashtag, so that was just the pound symbol. So she had a sweater that had a pound symbol and a fish. So she was like absolutely insane.
Well, no, she was trying to send a signal to Daniel. She's like, look, I got to get back to Columbus in a couple of days. I need you to get to pounding it. Like, it's like a subliminal message. Like, hey, I'm letting you know, this is what's up. Like, get in here.
To the plot line that you just started. Yes,
the double agent.
I don't think we can remind our listeners enough that this guy fought in Okinawa to the death. He fought a world-class karate guy to the death.
Trained by Sato.
But he needs a book to talk about sweeps. He needs a book to read at night for these all-important front sweeps that are sweeping across Southern California karate. He fought to the fucking death.
And the first time he meets Miyagi in the first Karate Kid, isn't he doing kicks from a book? And he's like, oh, that's bullshit. Like, Miyagi talks him into it. Like, that's the whole premise. Like, you can't learn from a book.
That's right. I forgot about that. He's doing kicks in his living room.
It all came full circle. How about that?
You can't learn from a book. Okay, we have to talk about the rappelling. So early on,
the attempted murder.
Yeah, when they're starting their bonsai business, Miyagi tells Daniel about some bonsai he planted way back in the day on some sheer cliff face that's basically impossible to reach. So Daniel gets the bright idea that now that Mike Barnes has stolen or karate chopped all their inventory, they need to go get this one tree because it could be apparently worth $10,000, to which Daniel says Miyagi could be set for life. I know. I don't know the 1989 inflation. I know $10,000 went much further back then than it does today. I don't know. And I know Miyagi was pretty old. Actually, he was only like 53, but he looked old as fuck. I don't know that $10,000 would set you up for life. But that said, he had planted it on the face of a cliff that was unreachable. It seems to me that he probably just wanted it left there. He didn't really want it back. He didn't put it in a place that was accessible. So Daniel and Blake Lively's sister get the idea that we'll just go rappel down there like fucking Navy SEALs because we have that training.
Yeah, those are like crummy Father's Day gifts I get for my kids. And I'm like, oh, let me just put this over here where like nobody can access it again because I don't want it.
Yes. They repel. They decide, hey, we're, and apparently Blake Lively's sister has some sort of experience with rappelling. She knows how to rappel, and she's like, oh, it's easy. You just do it like this. And it's like a 1,000-foot cliff that they're just cruising down. Did anybody find that strange, Steve Carbone?
Well, of course it was strange because, first off, we'd never seen Daniel do anything outside of karate that was remotely athletic. Like
he rode his first BMX movie bike and he played soccer.
Yeah, and not to mention, you know, trying to run from the Cobra Kais at the Halloween party. Yes. Where
he can't climb running. Fences.
He can't climb fences. Yeah. He had a 75-yard head start, yet couldn't get over the fence before five guys just jumped him. So the fact that he's rappelling down a cliff when we've never seen this guy have any sort of athletic skill in extreme sports was just fascinating to me to watch. And I'm like, okay, I guess we're just going to accept that this guy can do this. He's from New Jersey. There are no cliffs to go rappelling in New Jersey, really. I don't think
they didn't have the right. Yeah. They didn't have the right gear. They didn't have crampons. They didn't have helmets.
How about that? It looked like as realistic as the Burt Ward Batman climbing,
walking up the side of a building. Yes. Yeah.
How about this? For those of us who live in LA, Southern California,
right,
and those who used to, Steve.
Yeah,
where is this? What cliffs? Is there massive cliff in the Palisades that I'm not familiar with? Where exactly is this? Did they ever explain that?
It looked like Big Sur.
Well, I'm going to start with this. They pull the lines up from the bottom of the Descension. This is my question: what was Daniel and his chick going to do if they didn't have three karate trained men to pull them up?
Yeah.
What was the plan?
Yeah, I don't know
what
how
exactly
they would have
was
gotten
the
up.
Plan.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't. How would they have gotten up? Those things, unless they had tied them to trees and the goons untied them. I mean, they never really specified. The thing I found weird about that whole situation is when Daniel and Blake Lively's sister are at the bottom of the cove and the goons are at the top. They were talking like they were 15 feet apart from each other. They're having this conversation about, hey, the tide's going to come in 12 minutes. It's like, there's no way you'd be able to have that type. You wouldn't understand a word either side was saying to each other with a fucking tide coming in, waves crashing, yelling.
It's a 500-foot cliff.
Yeah. I mean, the way they made it look, yeah. It was like, huh? There's no way they could understand anything that was said. And he was being very specific, like, hey, sign the form. And then Daniel's yelling at him like, and Barnes is probably up there like, what the hell is he saying? Just sign the form and bring it up. Like, it was just, it was really, really,
it was
weird.
Honestly, I would like to nominate it for the worst sequence in Hollywood movie making history. I mean, it was just so unbelievable. It was so ridiculous. There was no block and tackle to pull him up. Like, I know Dennis and Snake are strong motherfuckers, but you couldn't just just pull somebody's dead weight up a 1,000-foot cliff. It just doesn't make any sense. That said,
and it's, yeah. I'd really want to know in the writer's room when they're crafting this film, they have to, because for the first half of the movie, Daniel's like, I'm not signing, even though he's getting his ass kicked and getting macaroni and cheese thrown on him. He doesn't want to sign because he knows Miyagi won't train him. He's like, I'm not fighting all these things. And they're like, how are we going to get Daniel to finally give in? Oh, I know. Let's put him in a cove down at the bottom. Attempted murder.
They would have to be
writers came up with that one.
The villains would have to be in on the fact that that Daniel and his girlfriend were going to descend down a cliff. First of all,
how would they know?
Yeah. And they were supposed to be in on the fact that they were going to have to descend all the way to the bottom.
Yeah.
And be basically left for dead. They would have had to anticipate all of this. And how about this? This application is so important to the movie. Daniel refuses to sign it. Miyagi refuses to sign it. Daniel finally signs it under duress, but it's like on a rock as he's hanging from a cliff. Like how legible could that signature be? Isn't just
and there's no notary. There's
right,
a notary
it, right, on right. That's what I'm saying. Is it just the commitment?
Just don't show
the
up.
Commitment to go to show up. Isn't that the important thing? Like, couldn't he just sign it and not show up? Like, why is this so fucking binding? The signature on that stupid application.
How many of us have said we're gonna go do some shit just to get the fucking person off our back, and then just don't go? Just fucking
reminds me of a time I one time got in a fight with a woman in a park. It involved our kids when, like, my kid was, like, 2. And she's like, I'm going to get my husband. I was like, well, go ahead. I'm waiting here. And then like, as soon as she left, I was like, all right, we're getting the fuck out of here. Yeah. Like, I'm not fighting some grown man. No. Like, I'm out of here.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, they never really specify why that – he couldn't have just been like, no, I signed it, but, yeah, I changed my mind.
So they escape.
Hey, guys, I have an update, a real-life update. As of 2017, on our boy Dennis, the third henchman.
Dead.
Nope. Running a dojo in Torrance, California with his wife.
Holy shit. Fuck up. That is amazing. So they escape death. Their Blake Lively's sister is threatened with gang rape by Snake. And
right.
And their biggest concern is, of course, the bonsai tree. It's got a broken branch. They race it back to Mr. Miyagi's little trees, and then they're doing like a full-on fucking mash operation where Miyagi's like, Peat Moss, stat! And they're like taping shit, and they're like, water, I need water! And they're like running water across the shop, and it's like a whole thing. It's like, what? I mean, you just plant the fucking thing. If it's going to live, it's going
to
live.
Is this when he drops the line, Mr. Miyagi, this is the 80s. We have to do something.
Yeah. Yes, that is in fact what? When he says that line.
Like ignore AIDS for 6 years? What? So, like pretend Bill Cosby isn't drugging women?
This shop has been tormented by the goons. Their one saving grace. Miyagi sold the truck to paying rent on this place.
Right.
And their one saving grace is now split in half because Karate's bad boy Mike Barnes said, make a wish, and then right. Split it in half.
Their tree. Yeah.
And now it's like, yeah, you're running to the aid. This isn't a child that is having trouble breathing and is turning purple. It's a fucking tree whose root split.
Yeah, it's a tiny little pine tree that should have been left where it was.
Yeah.
But that's apparently all the impetus that Daniel needs to go start training with Terry Silver, where Terry Silver makes him kick 2x4s. And it's, again, it's like, well, just one session, that first session, he basically was tormented by Terry Silver. Just don't go back. Like he's yelling at you and you almost break your foot kicking a board. Just, that's it. You don't have to return. And yet he goes back. What else?
The three rules. Quicksilver. Man can't see. Man can't walk. He can't fight. Man can't breathe. He can't fight. Man can't see. He can't fight.
Took 3 lessons, though. Took 3 lessons.
Quicksilver. You like that, Daniel? Yeah, I like that.
That's and Daniel really starts working out with her, too. He goes jogging with Robin Lively.
Yeah, he's in training. And then they, so then they, we have the dance scene where Steve Carbone recognizes that Glenn Medeiros is on stage, which is just crazy to me. Just one of the all time pulls I've ever seen. That it's, and of course Terry Silver is there. It's like a kid's dance club, and Terry Silver is a fucking adult hanging out there lurking. Well,
as Steve pointed out, he's younger than Daniel. He's true. Yeah.
That's true. Because again, Terry Silver with the deception in this movie, he's there to pay off some dude to try and get in Blake Lively's sister's pants to piss Daniel off so he'll punch him in the face and break his nose. Like, Terry Silver is like a mastermind of deception that, unlike we had anything we had ever seen in 1989, this guy's just fooling people left and right, and nobody has any idea what he's doing. But so he gets him to do that.
Again, his aim is to have Daniel lose in the All Valley Karate Tournament, and he's turning him into a bit of a sadistic killer, because some guy comes up and tries to dance with his girlfriend, and Daniel fucking in 1 second flattens the guy's nose like no big deal.
Yeah.
It seems to me like that's not what you want to teach the guy that you're intending to have take a fall in the final match, right?
You would think, but a part of me still thinks that he's making Daniel think he's better than he is. And building him up and saying, because remember when Daniel finally got the balls to fucking punch everything and kick everything and broke everything in the dojo?
Yes, yeah.
And Terry's like, you did it. You're ready to go. And Daniel's all fired up. Yeah, I'm good now. Like, I'm ready to handle Mike Barnes.
Right.
And that's the night they go to the club and he like takes it out on him. And then they run out of there and he's like, Daniel, you did it. Look at that. Somebody comes at you and bam, you don't think twice. And Daniel's like, whoa, what the fuck? Like, I lost my balance.
Yeah,
and, you know,
he gave him the confidence he needed. So then there's a more.
And I like that there are a couple establishing shots of like a heartbroken Miyagi. Like, he knows Daniel has fallen in with the bad crowd.
Yeah, the foreshadowing that
like he's all dead. He's all sad. Like, dear diary, Daniel, my rent boy is broken.
He no longer suck my dick in back room of shop.
No more ski pola.
No more prostate massage. No more nothing.
My Daniel-san no longer pillow biter.
So there's more training montages, and then we get back to Kreese shows back up, and he's
that's the night of the fight. Yeah, I mean the night that Daniel punches the dude.
Yeah.
And they leave the nightclub. Daniel goes back home to Miyagi and says, I've been training with Mr. Silver. He meant well, but I'm on the wrong path. I'm going to go tell him I'm done talking. I'm done taking his lessons. I'm going to go back there. And he's like, do you need any help? No. I'll take care of it myself. So he walks into the dojo.
Again, could have just called. Toll-free call back then. Just call it a Silver. Sorry about that. But no, he's got to go over there.
Yeah, goes over there. He walks in, says, I'm not going to fight in the tournament. He's like, no, you are fighting in the tournament. He's like, well, you can't make me do anything I don't want to do. And then he just laughs at him. He's like, the whole time you've been here, I've been making you do things didn't want to do. What are you talking about? I'm what he's talking about, shithead. And out walks Karate's bad boy, Mike Barnes.
Just
and
amazing.
They had him dead to rights.
Amazing turn. Fucking, yeah.
Right. Oh, they established this movie that the guy you're supposed to be pulling for in the movie is essentially Pete Puma from the Bugs Bunny, like, where he tricks him into asking for four lumps.
Who's that, three or four?
Like, that's Daniel-san.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
He is a moron in this movie. He's so stupid. He believed that Kreese was dead and that broke his heart. Like, he's the dumbest person on earth.
I don't think that could be, that point could be made enough, and that as annoying and unlikable as Daniel was in the first one, and then you rooted for him to die in the second one, he's even worse in this. Like, he's like one of those guys that doesn't pick up on nonverbals. He annoys people to a grating of fashion. He's a hero in a movie that you openly root against. And by the way, if the first movie was Crane and the second movie was just move to the side, pivot, what's the key thing? And is it the, what is
Mom
it called?
Jeans. Mom Jeans.
What is that?
No, it's his.
Wasn't it called what do you
kata?
Kata.
Something.
Kata.
What is kata?
I think that's like white belt level karate. Like I think that's like just like beginner level shit that he's doing, and that's why Terry Silver poo-poos it the whole time.
Yeah, he makes fun of it. Like, what's the last thing Miyagi taught you?
Oh, you're talking about the Tai Chi thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. His moves.
He's like, yeah, it's great working up a sweat. It's not going to win you any tournaments. So you need to win tournaments by punching things.
They got Daniel dead to rights. Mike Barnes starts fucking him up, which is weird because you need him healthy for the tournament. So you might just go, hey, we fucking got you, buddy. Anyway, head on out of here. We'll see you at the tournament. But Mike Barnes starts fucking him up. And then Miyagi shows up and he fucking he beats Kreese's ass in like 1 second. And then he's like kind of getting the best of Silver until he knocks him against a wall and some paint spills on Silver. And for some reason, Silver, while not injured, that's the end of the fight. He's like, oh my God, you've like messed up my knee. Like paint's touched me. I can't fight anymore. It's weird that it ends at that point. I mean, he breaks a mirror, but again, he's not injured. And to what audience is it believable that what Pat Morita is doing would be effective against those two much larger human beings?
What is the... I mean, all this establishes is that Pat Morita is selfish. Miyagi's selfish because he doesn't take one punch in any fight.
That's true.
And he's like, it's not like you're saying, well, you don't want the old man. Like, he doesn't even get hit. And he fucks up everybody in sight. And yet he's like, Daniel-san, it's time to learn your own lesson. Like, yeah. He's not even taking hits.
It is crazy. Yeah. He's like magic, basically. He's like an X-Man. Like he's
Yoda.
Yeah, he can't be defeated under any circumstance.
Now we've established, okay, Daniel's back with Miyagi. Miyagi's gonna train him. Yeah, will you train me now? Yes. Now Miyagi train you. And then we get the quick montages of the training for each one. It was kind of like Rocky 2, where Apollo is working his ass off and Rocky is before, when Adrian was in the hospital. And all the shots of Rocky training are him just sitting bedside and praying.
Yeah.
So in this training montage, fucking Karate's bad boy Mike Barnes is kicking Dennis's ass all over the floor. Yeah. He's breaking bricks.
Yeah.
He's breaking wooden planks. And they go to Miyagi and Daniel training, and they're on the beach in Santa Monica doing kata. What?
To me,
they never spar.
Yeah, nothing. He's not training.
Jason. To me, this movie keeps going back to my initial complaint. They were under some budget. Okay, they rented a helicopter for one day to do a bunch of picturesque shots that included the cliffs where they had to get the tree. It included like the forest where they were walking and they had to do a massive panoramic shot. And then they had like 19 shots on the beach from the helicopter view. That whole training montage thing was a way to maximize the amount of money they spent on the panoramic helicopter shots.
Makes a lot of sense. I mean, why not just use the montage from Karate Kid 1? It's basically the same. You wouldn't,
because it looks the same.
Right. But even in one, he was on the boat balancing, throwing punches, defending. True. This one, he's just on the cliff, and him and Miyagi are doing kata, and Mike Barnes is basically running through all of the valley with fucking his karate skills.
He wasn't even sanding fences. He wasn't painting floors. He wasn't painting fence.
If you look at like Terry Silver's grand plan, like he spent like $1.5 million on this whole thing.
Yep.
And then it's like, all right, let's not reveal it the night before the tournament and fuck him up. Like, let's leave him like 3.5 weeks so he can properly get back into regular training and mental shape. Like,
so he can learn what? Kata. So eventually we get to the climax of the movie. Of course, I'm talking about the All Valley Karate Tournament. And
a year later,
the true star of the movie, the one person that was in Karate Kid 1 and now is back in 3. Of course, I'm talking about Pat E. Johnson and his mustache as billed
the
as
referee.
he's an actual karate dude, by the way.
My favorite t-shirt, my referee t-shirt.
Yes, referee. Mike Barnes fucks everybody up in the tournament, just as you'd imagine. And then it's weird because Terry Silver is allowed to give a speech. And he does like a monologue speech to the thousands potentially of people in attendance at a local San Fernando Valley karate tournament, which is strange.
And it's been established there's only 5 competitors. So like, who are all these people showing up?
Yeah. Just karate fans in general.
All people that have subscription to the karate magazine that Terry Silver has a subscription to. It's like all these people are just karate junkies. Like people that show up at collectible shows. They just go to go. I want to watch karate. And oh, Terry Silver is going to speak to me too. And he's got a lot of insight in business and karate.
Yes.
And an ascot wearing Terry Silver too.
Yeah, he's rich. Ascot. He's letting you know he's rich. And the fight begins.
But his strategy, remember? He tells him.
What's that?
I need it to be tied and go into like sudden death.
Again, yes.
This is a questionable strategy.
Weird strategy. Where he's
this is awesome.
He's like, torment him. He's like, fuck him up and then get a penalty. So it's 0-0. Nobody has any points, so it can go into sudden death, which is what he's doing. Also, Mike Barnes, it's not real deferential to the referee, where the referee's like, okay, you guys got to bow. And Mike Barnes is like, fuck no, I ain't bowing. Like, it's weird that they would just allow him to continue the fight, where he should be like, hey, fucking bow, guy.
Yeah, it's win a point, lose a point for 3 minutes. Kick his ass for 3 minutes. We go to overtime. We go to sudden death. We get the point and we win. And that's obviously not what happened, but it just goes to show in those 3 minutes when Daniel got his ass handed to him yet again, that really it's like, I'm trying to make a sports analogy here, but I'm not gonna be able to come up with one, but essentially he got his ass kicked for 3 minutes and he won on a silly move. And yet, yeah, it's again, like, Cobra Kai's out of business forever.
Leonard Hagler. He just stole the last 10 seconds of every round.
Yep.
Like, he's not actually good at what he does. He just has found an ability to steal.
There is actually an Olympic analogy. The Russian bear, I believe his name was Yuri Karelin.
He never lost.
He had won every fucking Olympics. He'd never lost a match. He'd never had a point scored on him in any match. And he's wrestling, I think it might have been Atlanta
or Montana
or Seoul. Yes, he's wrestling Rulon Jones. And he's like, kind of like not, you know, it's kind of like a boring match. And no one scores any points for the whole match. And then they're going like, okay, sudden death. And all of a sudden that Rulon Jones like gets like slips out of something and gets 1 point and it's fucking over. And that, and Yuri Karelin, the greatest career ever in the history of the Olympics, ends with a fucking loss, a 1 point loss. And that's what happens to Mike Barnes. Mike Barnes is beating the living fuck out of Daniel. And let's be honest, it's kind of nice. He's like throwing him down and fucking elbowing him in the chest and just really hammering him left and right. But it goes to sudden death. And what happens in sudden death? Well, first of all, Miyagi gives some useless advice where he's like, karate not on mat, karate inside of you, like I was last night.
Right, it's a bullshit advice.
It was basically, you're losing to this guy because you're scared of him. It's okay to lose to opponent. You must not lose to fear.
That's right. Don't even lose to yourself.
Even though he was basically pissing himself on that mat, knowing that Mike Barnes was all up in his business for 3 straight minutes.
He's like, I can't win. Good advice.
The reason why I'm afraid.
Again, he's sitting there on the mat in the middle of the match saying, I can't beat this guy. I'm not any good. Yeah. He's way better than me. And then that's when Miyagi yells at him and tells him to pull his head out of his ass.
Yeah, just quit. So then he goes back to, they're like, okay, get on your marks. And he's like, fight. And Daniel starts doing his kata, which is just like basically like Ed was saying, Tai Chi. It's just like kind of like a dance where he's just like moving his hands around. And
Mike like, Barnes was like, karate. I'm sorry, karate's bad boy. Mike Barnes was like, hey, what the fuck is he doing? I don't know what to do.
No clue what to do. He's karate's fucking bad boy. He has no idea what to do.
You can become his bad boy by waiting to punch somebody in the face.
Yeah, all you gotta do is kick him in the leg or punch him in the stomach and it would be over. But he's standing there watching him do his dances and he's looking back for guidance from Silver and Kreese. And they're like, I don't know. What is this? What are you supposed to do? Just get the fucking point.
And they're telling him to get the point. Yeah. He's like, all right, well, I'll just try and run at him.
And then he's like, I'm going to run at him with my fist out. So he runs at him. And Daniel does like some judo move where he throws him over his shoulder and drops an elbow to the ribs. And it's fucking over. It's Rulon Gardner all over again. It's crazy. Yeah.
I think I need
Russian got the last laugh because Rulon Gardner was like caught in an avalanche and had his leg amputated.
Yes. Yeah, he's got no leg anymore. Wrong.
Yes,
yeah.
It wasn't his leg. It was just like a few toes, I think.
one thing we got to point out when before Miyagi came or right when Miyagi came out, or right after Miyagi came out to talk to Daniel and they were about to head to sudden death, Karate's bad boy Mike Barnes is like face to face with Daniel on the mat, just screaming at him, saying, get up there. Your karate sucks. You're a joke. One last trip to the IMDb page. Mike Barnes's final dialogue, where he triumphantly jeers Daniel into getting up for the sudden death portion of their grand championship match, was not in the screenplay, rather ad-libbed.
Shut up. Sean Kanan.
He ad-libbed. Get your ass up on the mat, you pussy, or whatever he said.
Star. What a star.
That shows how great he is because he gave the line that everyone watching the movie wanted to give.
Which was?
Get your ass on.
You're a fucking pussy, Daniel.
And I think he called Miyagi a slope in that.
He did. There was a second slope.
It was a second slope. Yeah, okay. There was two slopes. Call him a slope in that. So he basically gets off a racial bomb ad-libbed. So now we know that Karate's
in their defense, they never use the term zipper head.
That's true. Or worse.
Yeah. I mean, just the fact that that was ad-libbed makes me love Karate's bad boy, Mike Barnes, even more.
Amazing.
Like that's
awesome. Jason Stewart, your thoughts.
I don't think it could be stated enough. I don't think that this part of the plot could be stated enough.
Yeah.
This little kata thing completely confuses the biggest badass in youth hockey, I mean in karate, and it confuses his two world-class trainers. So much that it flusters him where Daniel could do a rudimentary move. And the only offensive point of the entire match for Daniel, because all the points that he's gotten to that point have been negative points from the bad boy. The bad boy did penalty points. Yeah. The only thing that worked was this kata thing. It's basically the equivalent, for those who haven't seen the movie, of you're in the middle of a fight, and you say, look, your shoes are untied.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
That's what the entire trilogy of plot comes down to is a stupid ass kata. I just can't get over that.
It's crazy.
Hey, Steve, I was looking at the credits and it says playing the role of himself, Glenn Medeiros.
That's right.
There you go.
That's right.
Just, I mean, where's Glenn Medeiros been since this movie?
He's probably cashing residual checks from Nothing's Gonna Change My Love For You. You ought to know by now how much I love you. One thing you can be sure of, I'll never ask for more than your love.
He only appeared higher on the call list than the two homeless sparring partners in the beginning, Spectator 1 and 2, and Tahitian Girl 1 and 2. That was it. Mrs. Milo, played by Frances Bay. I don't know who she is.
The
Jack Shack, like when he sends them off.
Daniel is a back-to-back All-Valley champion with basically getting his ass kicked five of the 6 minutes that he was in the championship match.
Yeah.
Career points.
And the guy totally sucked at karate. Like, he couldn't even pretend to be good. Weak kicks. The best karate he ever did was against a board.
And I'll ask this question that I asked in the second one. Now that we've seen all three, who wins a match between Johnny Lawrence, Chosen, and Karate's bad boy, Mike Barnes?
Karate's bad boy. For sure.
No. Chosen. Chosen's a fucking...
No.
Chosen cried. That was the problem. Chosen cried.
But he was trained by Sato.
He seemed like he'd be the best, but he cried. He cried over getting caught using illegal weights on the village fruit.
On the carrots. On the carrot sales.
When he was running that illegal ring to make an extra 30 cents on carrots.
I'm going with Karate's bad boy.
Jason Stewart, your thoughts, weigh in on Steve Carbone's question, who would win in a fight between Karate's bad boy, Mike Barnes, Chosen, and Johnny Lawrence, and go ahead and take a long dead air pause before you answer.
This is why I will vote for the bad boy of karate, in that I just think that he was the strongest character of them all in 98% of his scenes. Yeah. I guess everyone has their what do you call that? Their what was Superman's
kryptonite.
Everyone has their kryptonite, and I guess it's this slow plodding age-old karate move, but I have to give it to the bad boy of karate up until that point.
Yeah, because he dominated every single karate scene.
Yes.
Even in the first in the finals in Karate Kid 1, Daniel versus Johnny. Daniel won the first 2 points. He was up 2-0. That's when Johnny had the bloody nose. He went to crease, and he said, "No mercy," or "Sweep the leg," or was it "Sweep the leg"? I mean, whatever. Yeah, but Daniel was up 2-0.
I feel like Daniel's, he's like Samson, and mom jeans are his hair. Like, he survives on mom jeans. And like a half hour earlier, he literally tried to run him off a cliff and murder him.
Yes, yeah, but he doesn't want to swing his leg. Okay, let's wrap it up. Yes.
Well, I was going to say, end with the very last scene, which is like, for the trilogy, for the first time in three movies, even though we've all been under the assumption that Daniel is giving Miyagi back rubs and toe rubs and maybe some happy endings that are off camera. For the first time in three movies, instead of after he wins raising his hand or bowing to him, Daniel and Miyagi hug.
An embrace.
First embrace in three movies. Yeah, that was the whole point. It was to get everyone to finally see, like, this. They finally come out. They are out as a couple now. This is it. We're all watching it. Yeah,
does European Rusty's sister even show up at the final match?
Yeah, ooh. I don't think she's there. Blake Lively's sister.
She's going back to her Columbus boyfriend.
Yeah, that's right. She was
packing and leaving that night when Daniel went over there after he butchered the guy's nose.
That's right.
I'm not sure the timing. Is she with Art Schleister? Like, who? What Ohio State guy? Like,
I think that was a little before.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, so we
ended. Eddie George? I just think it was.
I thought it was so bizarre. Well, not bizarre, but it was like almost eerily creepy that this trilogy ends with the first embrace between Miyagi and Daniel. First time they'd ever hugged.
They got rid of the love interest.
It was just like, here it is, everybody. This is what you've all been hinting at, a 70-year-old Asian man befriending a 19-year-old kid who's 28 in real life. And here he is.
And the 70-year-old who's really 50 in real life.
Yeah. And here they are hugging. And fade to black. Like, that was their way to tell the story.
Yeah.
What about Andy Katzenmoyer? Was that 89?
No. He was like mid-90s.
Yeah.
Mid-90s? Okay.
Greg Fry, Scotty Graham.
Running backs?
Carlos Snow, James Bryant, Tyrone Harrison. One of those guys. It was one of those guys who was headed back to.
It was Herb Street.
I did.
It's got to be Herbie.
I did forget to mention that at at one point, it might have been after the final match, Miyagi and Danielson go back and rappel back down that cliff and fucking plant the tree that he almost
in those
died.
Climbing scenes that look as realistic as Godzilla and Mothra.
Really what you want to do is go rappelling down a sheer 1,000-foot cliff face with an 89-year-old Japanese man. Seems to make a lot of sense. Jason Stewart, anything to add? Long pause.
Hey guys, just by the way, and you can clean this up and edit. I was pushing mute so that everything would just kind of sound better. I was sacrificing for the betterment of the podcast.
You were binging it.
Maybe keep the finger hovering over the mute button.
But I do want to say this to kind of sum this movie up. All you got to do is look at the Wikipedia page. The last sentence of the reception the movie got. In 2015, director John Avildsen himself called this movie, quote, a poor imitation of the first one. and just to sum it all up, and a horrible movie. He called it himself a horrible movie.
Apparently he didn't see Terry Silver's performance.
Yeah. I mean, rest in peace, John, but you suck because I don't agree one word. I don't agree with one word of that. That doesn't sit well with me. No, thank you. Sorry, John.
Gotta disagree. Steve Carbone, you are the expert. You have the last word. Anything you would like to add? Karate Kid Part 3. We could not have done this without you. You are a savant for this film. What would you like to add?
How about 2018? Guys, I have to share something with you. As we know, this franchise is getting rebooted with our original actors, Ralph Macchio and William Zabka.
Yes.
In a YouTube Red show entitled Cobra Kai. The release date was just announced today, May 2nd. On April 25th, I believe it is. Let me check my email because I have already signed up for this. On April 25th, Fandango. One of those things, Fathom Events is putting on one of those things where they're going to do around the U.S. They're going to do a feature presentation of the original Karate Kid film. One night only, April 25th, in different cities all across the U.S. And then after you watch Karate Kid, you get to watch the first two episodes of Cobra Kai from YouTube Red. I already have purchased my tickets to watch it here. Cinemark Frisco Square in XD, Wednesday, April 25th, 7 o'clock.
I'm going. I like where your head's at, Steve.
By the way, Carbone, Stevie just saying that I've already purchased my Fathom event tickets.
Yeah.
I think he's the first human in the history of humanity to say that. The Fathom events, for the listeners of this podcast who don't know, they're that filler thing at the beginning of all your movies where they say, go see the ballet from Czechoslovakia on Fathom events. And I think I've actually sent this tweet several times. I can't wait to get my Fathom event tickets to that ballet. I'm sure the tickets are really filling up. Sign absolutely nobody.
What you're saying is the Fathom events people are like, man, we've sold one ticket to this Karate thing so far.
And it's one of those.
Well, we can't move the date. We've already sold that one ticket.
Guys, look at your phone. I just sent you the screenshot of my ticket purchase. So yeah, April 25th. It's April 25th for everybody. It's one night. It's only doing it. So all you got to do is check your local. You guys got to do this too. I think we should all do it and be sitting there in the back row just texting each other during the movie.
Yes, I'm doing
it. It's a Wednesday. You're
gonna defer to me on this? Okay.
It's a Wednesday night, which is tough for me, but I'll try to make it happen. I'll make an effort.
We don't know.
I just feel sad that he paid the $150 online fee.
He didn't want them to be out of tickets. He could show up and the thing sold out.
Well, here's the thing. Like, we don't know. We've seen the trailer for Cobra Kai has been released, and we've gotten very sketchy details about what's happening. But essentially, I guess the plot is 34 years later, Johnny is down on his luck because he hasn't recovered from a kick to the face 34 years previous. He's on his floor in his apartment, and he looks over, he's hungover, and he's drunk. He goes and sees that Cobra Kai is shut down. He intervenes in some kids outside. He steps in. One of the kids sees him fighting and says, "Hey, will you train me?" So basically, Daniel is a car salesman now in the valley, and Johnny reopens the Cobra Kai dojos, and they butt heads. Essentially, as well.
Fucking A. I'm in.
How badass is Cobra Kai going to be? Good. If we get a cameo by John Kreese, I will cream myself.
Will we get a cameo from Dutch,
Stephen Queen, Bobby, any of those Tommy. Guys? Like it's got to happen, right? I mean, Cobra Kai isn't a movie. I think it's a 10 episode series on YouTube Red, not Red Tube for
Jason Stewart. Yep.
Yeah. So this is a 10 episode series. They Kreese has got to be a part of this at some point, right? Has to be
100%. I can't How imagine is he not? He's too busy. I'm sure Marty Cove is his agent got a call 100%.
Yeah. April 25th, guys.
April 25th.
I've bought the ticket fucking a month in advance. And when I saw like they gave you the theater seating and you get to choose your seat. Two people had purchased tickets already. Two. I'm
wow.
three.
Wow.
Because I'm going by myself. Of course. I'm in the back row.
Yeah.
There's three people that have purchased tickets as of the other day when I purchased
unbelievable. It. So. All right, guys. Anybody have anything else to add besides Steve Carbone? Jason Stewart?
I'm good.
Ed Daly?
We have to end this because I got to go to the fathomevents.com. For the first time ever.
All right. I really appreciate you guys doing it. Steve Carbone, thank you very much. Ed Daly, of course, you are the man. Thank you. Jason Stewart, could not have done it without you as well.
Long pause.
Until next time. For Ed Daly, for Reality Steve, for Jason Stewart, I'm Brian Beckner. This has been episode 214 of the Baller Lifestyle Podcast. We will see you next week.
Goodbye.
You I see forever, oh so clearly. I might have been in love before, but I never felt this strong. Our dreams are young and we both know they'll take us where we want to go. Hold me now.